morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 9 o'clock on your Thursday morning. Coming up in a half hour on Fight the Empire. It's this year, I should say, marks the 20th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide. But to understand it, we need to go back a century. Per Fogering looks at the former kingdom of Rwanda, the misrule by two colonial powers, and the troubles that came with liberation and civil war. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we'll go straight to flashpoints featuring these stories: brute force and the use of torture in the U.S. public school system, also tracking white supremacists in the wake of recent killings in Kansas City, and the weekly report from the Electronic Intifada, hosted by Noro Barrows-Friedman. And at 11, it's a special hour-long Between the Covers with guest local writer Tom Spanbauer, the critically acclaimed author and founder of Dangerous Writing. That's all coming up, but first, it's Press Watch up next with Teresa Mitchell. News you're not supposed to know. Stay with us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sold Out Music Festival happening now until April 20th at venues all over Portland. The Sold Out Music Fest seeks to bring together people of all generations and backgrounds to celebrate the music that helps to bind our collective culture together. Legends of New Orleans jazz, the luminaries of Brooklyn hip-hop, the queen of modern soul music, and more are performing together under one banner. Bands, venues, bios, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me, won't you, for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. So, I'm sorry to say, Mike Rupert is dead by his own hand. Mean-spirited conformists, including writers at Raw Story, are already sneering at him. He rejected. Mike Rupert is known for a number of things. He was known for good police work and for calling out our secret police agencies on, what they do. And he rejected the official conspiracy theory for 9/11. And so the sneers are underway before he's even buried, so far as I know. But I reject the official conspiracy theory for 9/11, too. I think it's pretty ridiculous. And it's not because of Mike Rupert or any one person, but because F equal MA, and that's a reference to Sir Isaac Newton, in case, like most people, you've kind of forgotten that high school physics. Force equals mass times acceleration. F equal MA. Therefore, the G-forces would have rendered any non-G-suit wearing pilot unconscious, at least in that last swoop into the Pentagon. Can't get there from here. F equal MA. Got it? F equal MA. Therefore, the collapsing floors of WTC buildings 1, 2, and 7 could not have reached near free fall speed as they did without the prior forcible removal, and obviously by explosives, of the steel girders holding them up. Steel girders don't turn to dust, Matter of fact, steel girders are so darn strong that they can hold a building way up into the air. F equal MA. And that doesn't go away. I mean, and that's a good place to start. If you still hold to the official 9/11 conspiracy theory that those terrorists, Islamic terrorists, brought those buildings down by slamming into them with airplanes, buildings 1, 2, and 7. Sorry, that's physically impossible, and there's no going back on it. So, F equal MA in the official 9/11 conspiracy theory is impossible. Basic Newtonian physics. And yes, Mike Rupert was right in exposing that and in exposing the drug dealings of the CIA. And it should be remembered that it was Rupert's expert police work that, for example, first exposed the put options that massively profited from the anticipated fall in United Airlines stocks placed on the 8th of September 9/11. 8th of September 2001. And I respect Mike Rupert's courage. Even if I didn't agree with him about absolutely everything he wrote and believed. And the fight will go on. So RIP Mike Rupert. More on this topic in 24 minutes as Pairfoggering hosts Fight the Empire. And, well, the situation with corporate government and the deep state is pretty surreal. And Abby Zimet writes in commondreams.org, starting with the word surreal, she writes, charging that possible perpetrators broke the law and should be prosecuted, aggrieved Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein is investigating and has called on the Department of Justice to investigate the dastardly leak to McClatchy News Organization of parts of the 6,000-page report, finding the CIA repeatedly lied about a brutal torture program inconsistent with the U.S. policy positions regarding human rights torture that, in fact, didn't work. And departing from what she had written, I personally don't care that it didn't work. Of course it didn't work. I mean, if you torture someone, then they'll admit to anything. They'll admit to being behind the Norman invasion. It doesn't matter. Just stop the torture. Even if it did work, I'd be against it because it's torture, for God's sake. You know, fall on your sword if that's all you got is torture. I don't care. Can't get there from here, but returning to what Abby wrote, it seems the Senate is scandalized, not by the crimes committed in our names, but by journalists telling us about them. With a call for prosecution, the government thus maintains its admirable stance in only making accountable the people who reveal our nation's misdeeds. See John Kiriakou and Edward Snowden, but not those who authorize or commit them. And she writes, we have arrived at a sorrowful place. So speaking of people who reveal the crimes, after the Soviet-style show trial last year, Private Chelsea Manning was sentenced to 35 years in prison for the ghastly crime of revealing the now famous video record of U.S. war helicopter pilots gleefully massacring civilians in Iraq. This week, a proud general, Jeffrey S. Buchanan, of the Military District of Washington, upheld the sentence in full, thereby maintaining the example that says to all U.S. citizens, and especially service members, shut up about war crimes or we'll torture you too. In related news, seismic monitors trembled as every signer of the Constitution rotated in their graves. This is Press Watch. You're listening to KBOO Portland. A few news items. From the Voice of Russia, update on the forest fires in Siberia. 28 forest fires were burning on 3,500 hectares in the Siberian Federal District as of Wednesday morning. That's according to the District Department of the Federal Forestry Agency in Russia. The wildfires were raging in Buryatia. 12 fires on 83.7 hectares. By the way, hectares, multiply them by about 2.5 and you get acres. And the Transbaikal territory was also on fire. 12 forest fires were confined to 3,000 hectares. 61 forest fires were put out. It's quite a mess. The report from Voice of Russia basically this morning is trying to say that they're getting on top of it. But the big problem is that it's not forest fire season in Siberia. Globalpossibilities.org says that, according to the Siberian Times, National Resources Minister in Russia has warned that this year's fire season could be one for the record books. The forest fire situation is tense in Russia this year, he said at a conference chaired by Prime Minister Medvedev. Boy, I'm ready to stumble over pronunciation this morning. But anyway, he said, due to a shortage of precipitation, the forest fire season has begun almost 1.5 months ahead of the norm. 17 forest fires reported over 2,000 hectares. That's 1,000 hectares, slightly old news, as I would say. Slightly old news, but across Siberia last week, but century-old temperature records were shattered in Siberia's third largest city, Krasnoyarsk. Siberia's third was 70 degrees Fahrenheit. In Abakan, 70 degrees capital city of Kazakhstan, it was 77 degrees Fahrenheit. He said it was the hottest Siberian on record for several western Siberian cities, for several western including Novosibirsk, Tomsk, Gorno-Altaysk. The average temperature in Russia increased. The average temperature in Russia in years, he said, overall the temperature in the area in years, he said, overall the temperature in the area is 16.5 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the record set in 1989. Siberian wildfires may seem like a very remote threat in global possibilities.org, but what happens in this region has consequences on a global scale. Siberia is often lofted high up into the atmosphere that travels across the Pacific Ocean, blanketing the western coast of North America, that's us, with hazy, hard-to-breathe air. In 2012, smoke from Siberia caused record ground-level ozone in British Columbia. Smoke can also drift north from Siberia, depositing soot across the fragile Arctic ecosystem. Darker, dirty ice reflects less solar radiation back into space. Ice that absorbs more radiation melts faster, and in turn, less ice in the Arctic can affect weather patterns around the world. When land-based ice melts, it also contributes to sea level rise. Wildfires hasten the thawing of vital permafrost as well. Globally, the trees and frozen soils of the boreal forest lock up an incredible 30% of the world's carbon, but when permafrost melts, it releases vast amounts of carbon dioxide and methane, leading many scientists to fear that these ecosystems may switch from being a giant carbon sink to being an unprecedented carbon source. Departing from that print, what they're saying is that these methane clathrates under the water, and that the methane that is locked into the soil will continue to come out and may get to the point which it roars out. That's the clathrate gun, the methane gun. And the reason that's significant is because methane is so much more efficient at contributing to global warming. And you may also recall that it was soot from forest fires that contributed heavily to last year's unprecedented Greenland surface melt. Other factors are taken into play, including thermohaline failure. When I think of all this together, I think the reason the Pentagon, Homeland Security have taken such emergency precautions is probably because of the threat of a rapid intensification, let me put it that way, of global warming, which had, I think it's already happening, to tell you the truth. So, as long as I'm passing along bad news, Ebola is still happening. The Ebola virus in Western Africa is a new thing, a novel strain that probably evolved locally and circulated for months before the outbreak became apparent. That's according to researchers who are quoted by Michael Smith in the in MedPage Today. The index case, he writes, is probably a 2-year-old child from Guinea's Gekedu Prefecture, who died December 6th last year, several months before the outbreak was recognized in March. And he writes, the findings come from an early epidemiological look back and genetic examination of virus samples from 15 patients. Report comes as the World Health Organization is reporting the outbreak now includes 202 suspected or confirmed cases, 168 in Guinea, 28 in Liberia, 6 in Mali. There have been 121 deaths. And departing from this script, Haaretz has pointed out that these deaths are taking place in part in a place that has an international airport. So this could spread, and this is why I consider it to be news you're not supposed to know. And this is news you're not supposed to know. It's 9:15. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Returning to MedPage today. Meanwhile, the health ministry in Guinea was optimistic that the worst is over. A spokesman told reporters the rate of new cases has slowed dramatically in Guinea. And the outbreak, he said, is nearly under control. Reuters news agency quoted spokesman Rafi Diallo as saying, quote, the number of new cases has fallen rapidly, end quote. And he said the most recent cases are people who are not sick, but are being monitored because they've been in contact with those who've fallen ill. Quoting Diallo again, once we no longer have any new cases, we can say it is totally under control, but a end quote. But a spokesman for the World Health Organization told MedPage today it's too early to say that. The scientists studied samples from 15 patients and concluded the virus affecting them is the novel version of Ebola virus, which has 5 species. The first 3 have caused major outbreaks, in Africa. One has been responsible for a single human case, and there's one that circulates in the Philippines and affects non-human primates and not people. The virus, he writes, was apparently transmitted for months before the outbreak became evident. The researchers argued that it was a length of exposure that allowed many transmission chains and thus increased the number of cases. The clinical features were primarily fever, vomiting, severe diarrhea, but hemorrhage was not seen in all patients. Hemorrhage is the thing that makes this disease terrifying. Gunther, they write, and other scientist colleagues noted that the term Ebola virus disease rather than Ebola hemorrhagic fever takes that aspect of the outbreak into account. So they're saying this is a new thing. But they, reading between the lines, there is a certain amount of speculation involved in that. And as I was saying, the outbreak continues at this point. It ain't over. And it's not clear because it has a 21-day incubation period. Is not clear at all whether it's diminishing or spreading to a different form or different area. Worth watching. I'll continue to scan the news for Ebola virus next week. I want to talk about, political concerns a little bit. May Day is coming up. And May Day is traditionally that International Workers' Day. It's also Beltane. It's also a pagan festival. 1st of May. And I'm asking myself what I'm going to do on the day. I have that day off. And I'll be out and about. And I think I'm going to have a good time. I haven't decided exactly what. But I want to point out that it's not just an attitude, but rather a scientific fact that the U.S. is an oligarchy and not a democracy. And I can say that because there's been a scientific study. Eric Zeus is writing in commondreams.org. And he writes, a study to appear in the fall 2014 issue of the academic journal Perspectives on Politics finds that the U.S. is not a democracy, but instead an oligarchy, meaning profoundly corrupt. So the answer to the study's opening question, who governs and who really rules in this country, is, quote, despite the seemingly strong empirical support in previous studies for theories of majoritarian democracy, our analyses suggest that majorities of the American public actually have little influence over the policies our government adopts. Americans do enjoy many features central to democratic governance, such as regular elections, freedom of speech and association, and a widespread, if still contested, franchise. But then they go on to say it's not true, and that America's claims to being a democratic society are seriously threatened by the findings in this, the first ever comprehensive scientific study of the subject, which shows that there is instead the near total failure of median voter and other majoritarian electoral democracy theories of America. When the preferences of economic elites and the stands of organized interest groups are controlled for, The preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy. To put it short, the United States is no democracy, but actually an oligarchy. What are we going to do about that? I invite your calls. Number to call 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, having laid all that bad news on you, I've been thinking hopefully about May 1st, and I've been noticing that the revolution has been kind of growing through the cracks. It's about the commons. It's about the internet and collectivism. And David Bollier, writing in alternet.org about the commons, says it's worth noting that the commons is not just an internet phenomenon or a matter of economics. The commons lies at the heart of a major cultural and social shift now underway. People's attitudes about corporate property rights and neoliberal capitalism are changing as cooperative endeavors on digital networks and elsewhere become more feasible and attractive. And this can be seen in the proliferation of hackerspaces and fab labs, in the growth of alternative currencies, in many land trusts and cooperatives, and in seed-sharing collectives, and countless natural resource commons. Departing from that text, talking about stuff like community gardens. But the community garden idea is very much alive and well on the internet. He writes, beneath the radar screen of mainstream politics, which remains largely clueless about such cultural trends on the edge, a new breed of commoners is building the vision of a very different kind of society, project by project. This new universe of social activity is being built on the foundation of a very different ethics and social logic than that of Homo economicus, the economist's fiction that we are all selfish, utility-maximizing, rational materialists. Speaking for myself, that's the Economics 101 product, as in don't step in the product. Durable projects, he writes, based on social cooperation, are producing enormous amounts of wealth. It's just that this wealth is generally not monetized or traded. It's socially or ecologically embedded wealth that is managed by self-styled commoners themselves. Typically, such commoners act more as stewards of their own of their commonwealth than as owners who treat it as private capital. Commoners realize that a life defined by impersonal transactions is not as rich or satisfying as one defined by abiding relationships. The larger trends towards zero marginal cost production make it perfectly logical for people to seek out commons-based alternatives. This is Press Watch. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I'm talking about the revolution kind of growing out through the cracks. The cracking concrete of capitalism. And David Bollier in alternet.org writes, you can find these alternatives popping up all over in the 10,000-plus open-access scientific journals whose research is freely shareable to anyone, and in community gardens that produce both fresh vegetables and neighborliness, in hundreds of time banks that let people meet basic needs through time barters, and in highly productive, ecologically-minded, commons-based agriculture. And he writes, economists tend to ignore such wealth because it generally doesn't involve market activity. No cash is exchanged, no legal contracts signed, and no measurable gross domestic product is generated. Speaking for myself, but you get to eat the tomatoes. Get it? But the wealth, he writes, of the commons is not accumulated like capital. Its vitality comes from being circulated. And described in his book, he writes, Think Like a Commoner. The story of our time is the rise of the commons as a new way to emancipate ourselves from the predatory markets and to collaborate with peers to protect and expand one's shared wealth. This is a story that is being played out in countless digital arenas as Rifkin documents. He's talking about Jeremy Rifkin in his new book, but also in diverse contexts as cities, farming, museums, theaters, and indigenous communities. One reason that so many commons arise and flourish is because they help their participants meet important basic needs in fair, responsive, and socially satisfying ways. That's quite attractive to those who are otherwise held captive by conventional predatory markets. Once again, speaking for myself, that would be you, held captive by conventional predatory markets. In other words, you got to go to your job so that you can pay your rent or your mortgage, so that you can get some money for food and healthcare and all the things that you need. But outside of that, we have this new phenomenon, information that, you know, and I've gotten very used to repairing my car, for example, by looking on the commons on the internet, to find out what I need to do. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm competent at actually doing what it describes, but at least I can put the symptoms, you know, when my old car breaks down, I can look on the internet and get a pretty good idea of what's going on. That's for free. That's for commons. That's pretty much permanent. That's just the internet. And my garden is growing. My plum trees will probably produce this year, and I can trade the plums. And, you know, the IRS would like to tax those transactions. But I'm just going to go ahead and boldly say that I probably won't tell the IRS a damn thing about my plums or what I might trade them for. This is the sort of thing that we can all do right now. Speaking of internet, you want some free? Do you need some free stuff? You need furniture? You know, before I even say that, do you know how to look for bed bugs? That's on the net too. You can get free furniture. You don't have to pay for furniture. I haven't paid for furniture since I don't know when. I really don't know when. Craigslist. So I'm talking about the commons. I'm talking about getting things done for ourselves and the fact that it's creating, especially with this community garden sort of model, it's creating a revolutionary attitude without even being described as a revolutionary attitude. We're just doing it. Number to call 503-231-8187, and Christina is on the air.
Oh, hi, Teresa.
Hi.
First-time caller. I love your show. I've been listening for a long time. I don't always agree with everything that you say.
Well, you shouldn't.
But I really appreciate your perspective. I had two questions. My first question is, I was wondering if you would consider offering a podcast, because a lot of times I can't catch your show.
Okay, the way to get the recording is to, I mean, the way I do it, is I go to kboo.fm, and the reason I do this is because I forget the exact script for pulling it up directly. So I just do this. I go to kboo.fm, and then you'll see that I think I'll just do it right now as I speak to make it real and make it easy. I'll pull up a tab. I've got my got the Wi-Fi going here. I'm going to punch in kboo.fm. And a colorful page comes up rather slowly because I've got Windows XP. And when it does, I can find on the left side in the front a little button that says Programs. I punch the button that says Programs. And there are a great number of programs. So just to make it easy, I hit Control F. And I punch in PressWatch. And when I do that, it brings me to PressWatch, and there's a link. I hit PressWatch. And the program will appear about 15 minutes after I go off the air in recorded form. And right now, let's see, it says kboo.fm/presswatch, capital P. Kboo.fm, capital P, PressWatch. That's the difference, I think, where I get it messed up. And the top one is last week's program, and you can just click on it and listen to it immediately. And I'm glad that you asked how to do that. And there it is.
Oh, great.
And pull it up that way. Well, I can tell by the music that I'm out of time. Thank you very much for calling. And so next, coming up on KBOO Portland, we got Parafoggering, Fight the Empire. Stay tuned, and all the ships at sea.
To the Streets of Portland is a dynamic broadcast with a mix of music and conversations focusing on organizers and Black African Portlanders around the city. Tune in into the next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland with music and conversations featuring Michael Hicks of the Black Rose Books and the creator of the upcoming Portland Natural Hair Expo in May. Next installment of Ear to the Streets of Portland is Thursday, April 17th, starting at 7 o'clock p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, or online at www.kboo.fm.
People ask me everywhere, is that really all your
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagring. Show is Fight the Empire. Before we get into the show, I'd like to say a little bit about Mike Rupert. You know, we're really going to miss the guy. He's been a guest on this show several times. And a few years back, he's always been a friend of KBOO. And he, a few years back, he gave a talk at the Unitarian Church. It was a benefit for KBOO. He's a troubled guy, but he did a lot. He accomplished a lot of things. And I'm not going to say too much. You can go on the internet. He had an internet radio show called The Lifeboat Hour on Sunday evenings. And last Sunday, he did his show. His guest was Carolyn Baker, who is a writer and psychologist, an old friend of his.